Hello, everybody. This is The Rest is History, and we're coming to you today from Adelaide in South Australia. So, Tom, we are nearing the end of our trip down under. We have done shows in Auckland, in Melbourne, Brisbane, in Sydney, in Adelaide, and we're moving on to Perth. Are you having a nice time?
I'm having a lovely time. Although, confusingly, by the time, listeners, you were getting this, we'll probably be back in England, because I think we're landing on Wednesday. Yeah, we're having a wonderful time. So Adelaide, the city of churches, but also, of course, the city of serial murders. And the only other time I came here was when I came to a literary festival, and I heard a whole day of talks about all the hideous murders that had been perpetrated in Adelaide. And among those was the Somerton man, Dominic.
Yeah, that's a tremendous episode, Tom.
Who died or was murdered.
Yeah.
Still slightly open, isn't it? Open question. On a beach near where we're sitting now. So very exciting.
And if you're a relative newcomer to The Rest is History, Tom chose to do that as his episode on Australia when we did the World Cup series. And I loved that episode. Some people don't like, I mean, I believe, Theo, you're a bit of a skeptic about The Rest is True Crime. But I think a little one in every 300 episodes is fair enough.
Yeah. And I think also what, of course, Theo is missing is that it opened a window, didn't it, Dominic?
Oh, a lovely window. That's nice.
Onto a specific moment in Australia's past. And have you been enjoying Australia? It's been your first time here.
I have enjoyed it, actually. Yeah. The company's terrible, but the place is nice. Theo's slapping his thigh there.
I know.
Fake laughter.
The whole trip has been an absolute bantavalanche. You can imagine. It never stops.
Yeah. I have enjoyed it. The Australian people, very nice, very welcoming. Australia itself, tremendous country, actually. It's much better than I thought it would be.
I tell you what we found is that Australians really like us being rude about their history, don't they?
Well, the Australians like a bit of sledging, don't they?
They do.
They really love that. In fact, I will say this, we did a tour of the United States, and Americans are much less used to being teased than Australians are, because Australians just do it constantly.
Yeah.
So when we tease Australians, they're all sort of...
Yeah, I mean, the audience absolutely perks up.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas Americans, they're like, oh, golly, what's going on here?
All right.
Okay, Tom, do you want to start with question number one?
Okay, so we've completed the Aztecs. I wanted to apologize for the fact that I'd advertised there was an episode on the Windrush coming up, but there were kind of crossed wires from
that was poor.
Goalhanger headquarters
that was
back
poor
in London.
From Tom. That was poor behavior.
It's the time zone, isn't it? Basically, it kind of scrambles us.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Well, it certainly wasn't my fault. Let's put it like that.
Oh, Tom, that is
And then
shocking.
we've got JFK assassination thereof, big 7-part series, which you should have had landing in your feed. And maybe some of you will have listened to the whole lot by the time you get this. But just sticking with the Aztecs, Dominic, here is a question from Scott Kay, who is very interested in the behind-the-scenes stuff, like how much time did you record for the whole Aztec series and how much did you cut? And why didn't you just make it an 8-hour extravaganza a la Dan Carlin?
So this is the kind of question that Theo and Dom, our producers, describe as inside baseball. And they say, oh, nobody wants to know how the podcast is made. But for those of you who are interested how the podcast is made, and we do sometimes get these questions, we don't cut anything. I mean, we genuinely don't cut anything, do we, Tom? I mean, we might cut a joke if the kind of the woke consultants in the office say, oh, that's...
censor us.
Yeah, censor us. But I mean, that happens once in every 150 episodes. So by and large, when we sit down to record like we're doing now, what you hear is what we said. And there's nothing pretty much left out. So we do run over sometimes. And that just means we end up doing more episodes, as happened with the Aztecs.
Yes, because it's not that we cut anything. It's that we tend to massively go over our scheduled episodes. So I think you had said that this was going to be 4 episodes.
Yeah.
And I saw your notes and I just laughed. I knew it was never going to be 4.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be 8. But I think that's fine. And I think that we've become happier with going with a kind of sense of the natural length that a story might require in terms of episodes. So again, the JFK episodes are 7, and I think you planned them to be 4 as well.
They were meant to be 4, yeah.
So
I think the thing is that doing a podcast for us is so liberating because we can do what we like. And when we're halfway through recording, we say, oh, Theo, this is clearly going to be 2 episodes. Theo just kind of looks a bit depressed, but that's what it's going to be.
Just on the scheduling thing, that is also why there has been a certain degree of trouble with other scheduling, because we had scheduled Windrush and various other episodes for the slots that have been filled by the Aztecs and JFK.
He will not let this go, will he? This Windrush business.
No, I'm not. Well, I just want to, you know.
So stressed about it. And you listening, only getting like a fraction of the angst.
I did have quite a lot of chuntering.
Right. Why don't we make an 8-hour extravaganza a la Dan Carlin? The answer to that is we like to keep our episodes between 45 minutes and an hour because that is what people tell us they like. Lots of people listen to it while walking the dog or commuting or whatever. So that seems a natural length. I think there are people who like listening to 7-hour podcasts. I'm not one of them. I don't have 7 hours spare to spend listening to a podcast, and I don't think the majority of listeners are.
Yeah.
And if you are one of those people, you know, good luck to you.
We'll just stick them together.
Yeah, just listen to them one after the other. Right, Tom, you want to say one last thing about the Aztecs?
Yes. So this is from my friend William Han, who I met in Auckland, brilliant travel writer. And he has mentioned, Dominic, a possibility that a Chinese monk came to Mexico in 499. Mm-hmm. So a Buddhist monk, Hui Shen, he writes, walked into a city in central China and announced that he had just returned from a long trip to a marvelous foreign land called Fusang. Chinese historians recorded this story in the Book of Liang. Have you read the Book of Liang?
No.
Okay. And then in 1761, a French sinologist concluded that based on the description of the place and distance and direction from China, Fusang must have been in Mexico. And various authors carried on with the theory, and one claimed that Quetzalcoatl was actually a representation of this Chinese monk. So are you convinced by that?
Well, William Han told you this lovely story, which you were very keen to mention on the bonus episode. Indeed, Theo has had to edit this to allow you to put this story in. And you haven't mentioned that William Han ends his Twitter thread with the words, "None of this is very credible."
I just wondered whether you were convinced or not.
I think none of this is very credible.
Okay, well, in that case, that is the story. So
brilliant.
We don't think that Hui Shen...
Great story.
We don't think that Hui Shen got there.
William Han's happy anyway.
Although,
go on.
It is a kind of lurking theme, isn't it? The idea that the Chinese might have reached America.
I've never heard this story.
What was his name? The guy who... Was it Menzies? Somebody Menzies?
Yeah.
The year that China discovered the world?
That's a business class flights book, isn't it?
It is very much.
That's absolutely what that is.
But the question of why China didn't reach America is, I think, an interesting one.
You know what it is, Theo. You've forgotten your charger. No, you've got an 8-hour journey, a book of total tosh in the airport bookstore next to like business secrets of the world's great CEOs or whatever. Right, Tom.
But the Chinese loved it.
Good for the Chinese. I want to ask you this question. Let's move on. JFK, Jesse B has a question. If Lee Harvey Oswald, Tom, had lived to stand trial, would that have quashed the widespread American belief in a conspiracy?
I think it would.
You think it would?
Yeah. Don't you?
So the question is, knowing what we know about Lee Harvey Oswald, would he have confessed? I would say no. What do you think?
No, he wouldn't have done. But the evidence, I think, is so overwhelming that if it had been paraded in a court of law,
yeah,
then most people would have been convinced. And I think actually the thing that makes people really go hard on the conspiracy angle is the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald gets killed, because it makes it look as though he's being silenced.
Yeah.
And then the question comes, well, why is he being silenced? And it all kind of spirals out from that.
I think that's fair. I think if there had been a trial, it depends how the trial had gone, doesn't it? And it depends how vigorously Oswald would have protested his innocence. But think about, for example, I mean, there's much less controversy about the murders of Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy.
Or John Lennon.
Yeah, because we know who the murderer was almost beyond any possible doubt. I suppose because there was a trial, there was a sense of a lack of closure, I suppose, to the story. Do you think?
There is a lack of closure. But again, I think it's because the fact that Jack Ruby is such an odd character. When you look at his life, you can kind of connect him to various shadowy organizations that you might, if you wanted to, think might have had a role in Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah, mafia. Yeah.
That the conjunction of Lee Harvey Oswald seemingly being silenced and Jack Ruby, this very odd character with his fingers in lots of odd pies,
yeah,
I think is what creates the whole story.
You never want to have your finger in an odd pie, do you?
No, you don't.
Right. What's the next question?
Okay, so this is from Jacobite James. What do you think about Philippa Langley's discoveries about the princes in the tower? So this is, Philippa Langley is the woman who found the body of Richard III in a car park in Leicester.
Lovely.
And she's very, very convinced that Richard III has been maligned, that he was a great guy. And as part of her ongoing campaign to demonstrate that Richard III was a goodie, she has now been trying to demonstrate that the princes in the tower weren't murdered and in fact had survived and were part of a wave of pretenders that launched themselves on England during the early years of Henry VII's reign. But of course, you know, if she's right, they weren't pretenders. They were actually the princes in the tower and therefore the legitimate kings of England.
So specifically, her discovery, as Jacobite James puts it, is that they were Perkin Warbeck and Lambert Simnel. These two very famous pretenders who, you know, if you did medieval history at school or something, you will know them with their ludicrous names.
Yes.
They're always invading England and being defeated.
And being variously sent to the kitchens or being hanged.
So, do you want to know my opinion about this, Tom?
I do. I think I can probably guess what it is.
But I think this is absolute gibberish and tosh. I think it's total nonsense.
Okay, Dominic,
yeah.
We haven't seen this. Have you gone over forensically the evidence that she's
presented? I've read all the stuff. I've read the articles. I've read all the accompanying nonsense. We did this to death in our kind of Princess and the Tower episode.
Literally.
I think we did two episodes, Theo, pointing out. I think we did, didn't we? Did we do two episodes?
Yeah.
I think, you know, Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is usually in history the best. The idea that these two kids resurfaced as pretenders, that most people at the time thought they were pretenders, they didn't think they were the real thing, did they?
No.
And on top of that, the truth of the matter is, of course, that Philippa Langley has not approached this. This is the difference between Philippa Langley, I would say. Lots of people will be across about this because they love the idea of like an amateur historian cocking a snook at the academic establishment. But the thing about Philippa Langley is she approaches this story and she's so party pre. I mean, I don't care whether Richard III killed them or not. If it turned out that he hadn't killed them, I mean, it wouldn't bother me whether he's a bad man or a good man. None of us can know whether he was a good man or not. It's a ridiculous argument. The sort of Ricardian argument, he's this tremendous hero. You're going on such fragmentary sources. You can't possibly claim to know what is in the man's heart or soul, as George W. Bush said of Vladimir Putin. So that, I think, is ridiculous. I mean, she obviously approached this. She knew she wanted to, in inverted commas, discover something that would exonerate Richard. Surprise, surprise, she did. You know, she didn't approach it in the way that somebody writes a PhD thesis to try and test a hypothesis. And, you know, they're prepared to be surprised.
She was like a barrister.
She was a barrister making a case from the very beginning. And she found what she wanted to find. She chose a theory that, while not the most ludicrous theory...
Well, the most ludicrous theory, Dominic, was one that she was promoting, I think, only 2 years ago.
Correct,
which was that Edward V retired to Devon and his secret identity was recorded in lots of Dan Brown-esque codes that are written all over the church.
Yeah.
And that one, as far as I can tell, has been completely jettisoned.
Yes,
now. She's
gone very quiet about that. I think if you're constantly coming up with these theories, so as we said with the whole JFK business or any of these things, if you're constantly promoting conspiracy theories, a la Graham Hancock, then you can't complain when people don't take them seriously. The other thing about Philippa Langley that I don't hold in massively high regard is her habit of constantly sort of dissing the academic establishment and saying, oh, big academia are trying to silence me and they've been suppressing the truth for all these centuries. I mean, the idea that basically you'll cannibalize the research of generations of medieval historians and then turn on them, I think it's very poor, Tom. I think it's Philip Pullman on Tolkien and Lewis. That's what it is. I don't approve of it.
But, Dominic, on the subject of academic historians,
perhaps
kind of doing the same thing, having a goal that they want to meet, an argument that they want to be fulfilled. I mean, it's not unknown, is it? Because another thing that has been kind of rumbling in the background while we've been in Australia is a series of stories about academics and perhaps particularly curators in museums coming up with extraordinary claims.
Yeah. Fouling their own nests,
that
Tom.
Remarkably seem to tick boxes that need to be ticked.
So give us a couple of examples.
Right. So I saw one, which was that a museum in the Home Counties, I can't remember where exactly, they have a coin of a notorious emperor called Elagabalus.
It's Hertfordshire, I think.
It's Hertfordshire. In the 3rd century. And they have announced that because a notoriously unreliable source claims that Elagabalus...
It's Cassius Dio.
It's Cassius Dio, but it's also in the Historia Augusta.
Oh, yeah,
so the sources for the reign of Elagabalus are notoriously an absolute bog and very, very treacherous. But the curators have decided that it's entirely reputable, entirely to be trusted, and that because there is a comment in it that Elagabalus wanted to become a woman, therefore he is trans and therefore should be referred to as she.
Or as most people say, trans, just to interpret that for 99.9% of our listeners. Go on,
so this seems to me a grotesque misreading of the sources.
Of course, because Tom, is it not the case that basically this is a classic formula for dissing emperors, for saying they're very effeminate and they actually are sexually perverse and all this kind of thing? I mean, these are accusations that would be leveled at any Roman bigwig by their critics.
But it's particularly sharpened by this because Elagabalus is not really his name. Elagabalus is the name of the god, which he was the high priest in Syria, where it was claimed by legions that he was the illegitimate son of an emperor who'd been murdered there. So he comes from Syria, and Syrians are endlessly being derided by the Romans as effeminate. And to that extent, calling Elagabalus a woman is to engage in absolutely the kind of racist...
homophobic, Tom.
Homophobia that Syrians had to put up with. And so, you know, it's pandering to Roman prejudice in the most remarkable way. Now, that's not... it is possible that maybe he wanted to become a woman, but we don't know.
Yeah.
We just cannot know. And even if he did, the idea that that can be mapped seamlessly onto the ideological assumptions about gender of someone in Britain in 2023 is, again, an absolutely enormous stretch. But you can clearly see, I guess that it gets the museum in the newspapers. It attracts attention.
Tom, I'm just going to come out like swinging here. I think that museum has shamed itself. And I think on top of that, it's a symptom of a wider problem. So another massive story this week in England, in the sort of world of museum studies, I'm giving that discipline all the reverence it deserves, is this. The Museum of London, to cut a very long story short, and people who love that museum's efforts will say, oh, Dominic's being very simplistic here and abbreviating it, but we can't go on all day, so I'll just crunch it down. They have found these bodies, 100-odd bodies, I can't remember how many there were exactly, in a plague pit. They've measured the skulls.
Yes, like a kind of Nazi racial scientist.
Of some of the bodies to try and claim that some people, particularly some of the women, are of African descent. They're literally measuring like the size of their kind of brow and their eye socket and stuff of the skulls, which again, as you say, Tom, it seems very 1930s behavior.
Very.
And on the basis of this minuscule sample, they say that there were black women in London who were more likely to die of the plague, and they found a tame academic who has said to them, oh, this is proof of a structural racial inequalities in healthcare in the 14th century.
Yeah, 1340s London.
And this study has come in for a terrible beating. So Kemi Badenoch, who is a Conservative cabinet minister, kind of came out swinging against it and just said, you're making a mockery of black history, actually, by doing this kind of thing.
I think quite a lot of people have said that.
What do you think about all this?
Well, I pretty much agree with what you think. There seems to be absolutely no evidence for it. And the idea that, skulls can be measured and racial categories can be drawn up
on
the basis of skulls seems to me
so dodgy.
Very unsettling.
So dodgy.
And it is. I think a few weeks ago, DNA tests were done on the body of a woman whose skull had similarly been measured and identified as coming from sub-Saharan Africa. And I think a plaque had gone up at a cricket pavilion in Sussex.
All right.
And subsequently, DNA tests were done on this body, and it was found most likely to have come from Cyprus and definitely from Southern Europe.
Oh, right.
So I'm absolutely not a specialist in the measuring of skulls and the degree to which you can find where they came from based on skull measurements. But that case would seem to point to the fact that there's quite a lot of wishful thinking going on here.
Total wishful thinking. It's total projection, isn't it? It's the projection of our own political obsessions onto the past. And an attempt to basically to reorder the past to make it look like the present. So people say, well, we live in a multiracial society today, and in order to, to facilitate kind of harmony, domestic harmony, we should reorder the past. We should find in the past what we want to find to make us feel comfortable in the present.
I guess the Museum of London serves Londoners, and lots of Londoners do come from Africa.
Yeah.
And so, I can see that the idea that that might make people with an African heritage going to the Museum of London, looking at exhibits on the Black Death might make them more interesting. I can kind of understand why they would see that. But I think it's a stretch, and I think it underestimates the interest that people would have no matter where you come from.
Yeah, correct.
Subject.
I think exactly that. I think it's incredibly condescending to Black Londoners.
Yeah.
To imagine that they're only interested in seeing, they're not interested in the Black Death, or they're not interested in 12th century or 11th century England. In itself, they have to use it as a mirror. I don't think they do. I think a lot of academics and, inverted commas, activists, self-described activists, are determined to see the past as a mirror, to see themselves in the past. But I don't think most ordinary punters go to museums. I think people go to museums as they go to history, to see a different world.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
To see the L.P. Hartley kind of quotation.
I do.
Okay, let's end on a more lighthearted note, Tom. It's from Ethelfrith. So an Anglo-Saxon question for you. If you can ask one historical figure one question, who would it be And what would be the question?
Well, I guess, bearing in mind today's topic, it would be Edward V, and I'll ask him, who killed you?
Perfect. That is the perfect way in which to end. So we're in the middle of the JFK series. Ahead lie the Allied invasion of Italy. We have a tremendous Victorian mystery.
We have the long-awaited and briefly cancelled episode on the Empire Windrush.
We have loads of fun things, and we're looking forward to Christmas when we'll be having Tom's Roman Christmas and other delights. So as always, thank you so much to all of you for your support of the podcast. We really do appreciate it. When we are back in England, we will be back into our usual recording schedule, piling up episodes for your delight. So on that bombshell, Tom, goodbye.
Bye-bye.